This is Fuel.
Fuel for thought.
Fuel injected.
Fuel for your business.
Jet Fuel.
It's about how you make people feel like they belong. Because it's all very well getting people in the door, and then you can tick off that box and say, yeah, we've got some working class people in. But it's like, do they feel like they belong there, and do they feel comfortable? And again, just making sure that you're setting up the right environment and you're not putting people in positions that they're uncomfortable with, and or that where you're setting them up to fail. And I think that's a big part of Commercial Break's work, which I thought was a really smart sort of distinction for them to make.
Hello and welcome to Fuel, the new business podcast for creative agencies. Now, this episode's all about luck. We're interviewing Andy Nairn, who's one of the co-founders of Lucky Generals, on his book, Go Luck Yourself. Because anyone working in creative agency new business knows that luck always plays a part in their work. And Andy explains that luck is having the skill and smarts to spot opportunity and turn it to your advantage. More importantly, this show's about the fact that Andy wanted to write the book to benefit the charity Commercial Break, an organisation that helps working class talent break into the creative business. So not only does Andy reveal some incredible tales of luck, we also talk about a very controversial subject, namely how the creative industry can address accusations that it's become too left-wing and middle class and not at all representative of the general population. And this is something we've discussed before with creative director Steve Harrison and Tim Lindsay, chairman of the DNAD. Andy also reveals his top three best commercials of all time and finds himself strangely drawn to Alaska. But get this, this show is also a working example of Andy's definition of luck, spotting opportunity in unexpected places and how to turn misfortune into good fortune. Because as one of the hands-on co-founders of Lucky Generals, which is one of the most in-demand creative agencies in the world, just ask Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson, Andy is a very, very busy man. But this week, he was resting at home recovering from surgery for a detached retina. So he had a bit of time on his hands, and I asked if his mouth and ears still worked, perhaps we could talk about his book and I could record it. And he said yes. This is a real-time example of turning misfortune into an opportunity to spread some luck around, and this is a landmark show, so stick around because we're going to dive straight in. But we can't dive straight in without saying some nice things about the good folk working away at the sponsor of this show, The Advertist. New business tools, news, insight, and data for creative agencies. There are two types of new business: referrals, which you take care of, and new business, which we take care of. New business plots the future path of your agency. It's, to paraphrase Wayne Gretzky, putting your agency where the puck's going to be. So if you look after the referrals, your new business strategy isn't complete unless you're looking to build new relationships in new and interesting areas. And that's what The Advertist is all about. It's used by the people that matter in the world of agency new business because it's reliable, up-to-date, informative, easy to use, and it's not going to break the bank. In fact, it's downright affordable. Repeat business is the hallmark of The Advertist reliability, and if you're interested in being a long-term client, give the team a call on UK number 0203 356 3717 or just email hello at theadvertist.com. That's theadvertist.com. Or just look me up, Keith Smith, on LinkedIn and say hello that way. New business news, contact data, tools, tips, research, tenders and reports updated daily on over 8,000 of the UK's leading and freshly funded businesses. It's a positive emporium of new business possibilities for your creative agency. Okay, that's it. Let's go and meet Andy Nairn and discuss how to spot and make luck and how to broaden the creative industry's talent pool. Are you lucky? When was the last time you were lucky? Can you remember the circumstances of that luck? To me, good luck is one of those things that we blame when we don't want to take all the credit for ourselves. And my guest this week, Andy Nairn, is arguably one of the most influential leaders of the advertising industry. And he makes the case that luck is chance times experience, and that when you're trying to achieve something, you can tip the odds of success in your favour by being aware of factors that others fail to notice. He's just written a book all about this phenomenon called Go Luck Yourself, which I've been avidly reading and studying all week. The theory follows on from a previous show I had with Dr. Chris Arnold, who pointed out that his dyslexia became a superpower as an advertising creative because he approached problem solving from alternative directions. His changed perspective gave him insight that normal lateral thinking blew right past. And my guest, Andy, is perhaps best known as one of the founders of the planet's most highly regarded agencies, Lucky Generals, the fiercely creative company whose client list reads like a who's who of modern commerce. Amazon, Co-op, Tailors of Harrogate, Zoopla, Panini, OnePlus. I could go on for the rest of the hour. But suffice to say, clients are on a mission to grow their incredibly valuable brands in the hand of Andy and his partners, Helen Callcraft and Danny Brooke Taylor. Andy's also the chair of sports marketing agency Dark Horses. And if we had time, we'd have another chat all about sports. The creative work of Lucky Generals is legendary, but Andy points out that often the difference between a good campaign and a stellar one is the ability to notice the hidden gems that, when you bring them to the fore, make a brand stand out and ultimately increase sales. Because Andy's an industry figurehead, he's also no stranger to podcasts and interviews. So when I invited him to come on the show, I wanted to talk about the headline that often gets buried in these interviews, the fact that his book's royalties benefit the advertising charity Commercial Break, which is focused on increasing working class representation in the creative and marketing industries. Something I recently discussed with Tim Lindsay, the chairman of the DNAD, and something that's close to my heart because, guess what? I come from a very typical working class background. If anyone has a right to an opinion as to whether the creative industries are too elitist or not representative of the general population, it's Andy. So let's welcome aboard the creative industry's very own working class hero, Andy Nairn. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you very much. Amazing. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Oh, dear. And you're keeping well, I take it, apart from your eye injury, which I hope is getting better.
Yeah, I tore my retina a little while ago, which is, it's not a great thing for somebody who is pontificating about luck. It's like when you sort of go to see your fitness advisor and he's out of shape. So, yeah, we'll just brush over that bit, will we?
Well, I mean, again, reading from your book, you would be typically looking to turn this to your advantage in some way, shape or form. So it gives you time to do things like podcasting and
yeah, very much. That's about the only thing I can do.
And anyway, this episode falls on International Podcasting Day. So happy Podcasting Day. And I looked up things to do on such an auspicious day. And one of them is to ask people about their favourite shows. Do you actually listen to any podcasts?
Do you know, what do I listen to apart from businessy ones? I've been binging on audiobooks release rather than podcasts.
Okay.
Especially because of the eye. So I've been going through lots of sort of books, you know, 10-hour slugs of books at the moment. I'm doing Money by Martin Amis at the moment.
Oh, wow. Yes.
If you've ever read that, it's a very dark glimpse into, you know, a story of an advertising director and an absolutely horrendous, monstrous character. So I suppose that's kind of related to our industry.
Well, if you wanted to take a quick departure, might I recommend a podcast called Blackout, which is I've just finished listening to it, and it's one of those ones that it's almost like the radio plays of old, and it's brilliantly done. It's we're in conjunction with Sonos, the speaker people, and it's a fantastic kind of story about what happens when all the power goes out around the world.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great little story. But anyway, thank you for visiting this little podcast. And I got to say right out the gate, this is a great book. So thank you for putting it together. It's got some lovely kind of bite-sized points and case studies, hugely accessible and impossible to put down. And I just kept saying to myself while I was reading it, I was going, oh, I'll just do one more section. And so much of it kind of resonated with me from like the responding to the pandemic, the Lucky Rabbit story, building back better. Inspiration and taking ideas from elsewhere, because the book just, it's an instruction manual. I love it. So well done.
Thank you. That's really nice of you to say so. Yeah.
And by the way, audience, I noticed yesterday that Andy's giving a talk tomorrow for the Bristol Creative Industries, and they're charging 15 quid a ticket. So this podcast is excellent value. First question, Andy, do you consider yourself to be a lucky person?
Well, I do. After that build-up you gave me, I feel very lucky to have been given that amazing sort of billing. So thanks for that. Yeah, I would actually. I feel like, I mean, I was born, first of all, a white bloke in the latter half of the 20th century in a developing country. So that in itself, Warren Buffett, you know, the sort of, gazillionaire, uh-huh. He's called that... winning the ovarian lottery. Like if you just if you start life before you do anything in your life, you're off to an amazing start because the chances of being born at that particular moment in history with some of those demographic advantages puts you massively ahead of huge numbers of people in the whole course of humanity. So that was pretty helpful. And then I guess through my life, yeah, I've had lots of very, I've never been one of these people, although it's weird because my sort of job title at various stages has sometimes been to be a planner. I've not done very much planning. I've just kind of let things happen and stumbled on various things, you know, on university courses and jobs and stuff like that. And it seems to have panned out all right. So, yeah, I'm a massive believer in luck in my sort of personal life as well as in my career.
Well, I kind of stuffed words into your mouth right at the very start there by saying that how you define luck. But, I mean, what is your definition of luck?
Well, I think that's what I discovered. And by the way, I didn't know anything about this and still started writing the book. I was a bit embarrassed, really. It was a bit ridiculous that I've got an agency called Lucky Generals and I literally knew nothing about this subject. So it was shame that made me sort of do the book, I think. But what I discovered was there's a couple of different sorts of luck. There's the sort of fate, which is the sort of blind luck, I guess the luck that you're born with, the luck that you can't do anything about. It's not achieved through your own means. And then there is, you know, something a little bit more like we sometimes call serendipity, which is more when opportunity meets prepared mind. I think that's one of the best definitions I've heard of it. So opportunities present themselves in our lives, but we've still got to have a skill and a talent and our eyes open to recognise what those opportunities are and to make the most of them. So, and that seems to be the most useful sort of luck. We can't do anything about fate. We can't do, you know, very much about the stuff that happens to us, but we can make luck happen to us. We can make ourselves more likely to be lucky, and that feels like quite a useful sort of luck.
Yeah, and you say, don't you, during the course of the book, you know, it's spotting it when it happens, and I think that's a kind of definitely a skill that sort of takes advantage of luck. But you know, it's the ability to see it when it turns up, I guess.
Yeah, very much. And, you know, we're all so busy with our lives and with our day jobs and our sort of pressing concerns and what is urgent that we sometimes don't glimpse, you know, opportunity can be on the other side of the street waving at us or shouting at us, and we're just too busy and we don't notice it when it comes knocking at our doors. And or sometimes it comes, you know, in disguise. You know, there's that old phrase, you know, blessing in disguise, where something happens to us that at the time feels like really bad luck, and we write it off or we think, you know, negatively about it. But if we pause and think about it, actually, it might turn out to be an amazing opportunity. So a lot of the time it's just being sort of mindful of your luck and conscious of it, I think.
Because we, as a culture in the West, we almost think like luck is not a very, you know, it's a negative thing. There's a negative perception of it in that we didn't create it; it just happened. And I think that, you know, that's not the same throughout the rest of the world, is it?
No, that was one of the interesting things I discovered. I mean, I didn't really know this so much, but the West, we like look down on luck because, as you say, we've all been brought up with the Protestant work ethic, you know, this idea that hard work, you know, there's no such thing as luck. And the harder you work, the luckier you get. I mean, you hear that a lot, don't you?
Sure.
And that was because of the Industrial Revolution, you know, when the Victorians basically believed that if you were rich and successful, that meant that you had worked hard and sort of God had smiled upon your endeavours. And if you were poor, it was your own fault, you hadn't worked hard enough. And that's really sort of still run through a lot of Western culture. Now it's just like work, work, work. And it's making us all ill and frustrated and, you know, and doesn't really often get creative results. I mean, obviously, we've all got to work hard to some degree to succeed. But after a certain point, just slogging away doesn't make you any more successful, I don't think. So what I've found really interesting was that all these ideas from the East that have been honed over thousands of years, we are sort of now discovering through science and psychology that they really do work. And we're sort of almost like rediscovering them and thinking, well, that's an interesting thought. And perhaps not acknowledging the fact that somebody's been doing that for thousands of years in other cultures. But you know, ideas like karma, which is yes. also an Indian idea, you know, there's now loads of research that show that that sort of idea of, you know, giving generously can actually benefit the giver as much as the recipient. But that's been standard practice in lots of cultures for many years. Or, you know, the Buddhist sort of sense of appreciation of the things that you've got in life. You know, again, there's lots of research now that shows if you take a little moment in your day to appreciate the good stuff in your life, then that is, you know, that is proven to help you more likely to succeed. So I found it fascinating, all these old ideas and philosophies, but also the modern science that now backs them up. It kind of felt like an interesting subject.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I was, as I say, it's a very engaging read. And I think the way that you managed to kind of to put the examples together in sort of very concise, easy to digest, sort of simple stories, I think was very well done. And obviously only somebody like you probably could have put them together, but so thank you very much. It is a good book, and I'll stop bigging it up now. But at the top of the show, I mentioned Dr. Chris Arnold. I mean, I don't know whether you know him, but he was on the podcast a couple of months ago. And his ability to approach problem solving, sort of basically, he looks at problems from a kind of downside up perspective, and because of his dyslexia. And I did a subsequent show with Tim Hollins, Greg Jordan, and Martin Galton of Beehive as well, and we talked about juxtaposing two seemingly kind of unrelated items or thoughts about. Solving creative problems. And lo and behold, as soon as I open the book in the first part, you give some great examples of using strategies from unrelated industries to answer advertising and creative briefs. So I've got a two-part question here for you. I mean, the first one is, do you think that this kind of approach has been a Lucky General's kind of hallmark in its campaign? And secondly, is the wider advertising industry sort of guilty of feeding on itself creatively? And how can we change that? So, I mean, is that Lucky General's hallmark, this kind of different way of looking at things?
I think it is, maybe unconsciously, because, you know, we just think there's a world out there. We never really wanted to be an ad agency. My creative partner, Danny's very, very much about everyone having very diverse influences and hates this whole sort of ad culture. Doesn't like, you know, the worst thing you can do if you're a young team working, you know, with Danny is if you come back with an addy idea that looks like it's been made for ad land. You know, we're much more interested in culture and all the other amazing cool stuff that goes on out there that we you know, that we actually pay to consume, you know, rather than the stuff that's forced on us, you know. So whether it's music or sport or drama or the arts or, you know, literature or, you know, science and all sorts of things, we've taken inspiration from all of those places. And I think that the danger is, to the second part of your question, is that because everyone is working hard because of this kind of Victorian sort of sense that everyone has got to get their heads down and consistently sort of work harder and harder and harder, it does make you quite insular and does make us focus on the brief that we have been given rather than the brief that we could create for ourselves. We always encourage everybody to look at a problem from all sorts of different angles and actually to force yourself to do that, because sometimes that happens by accident, doesn't it? You know, like we make the classic example, you go for a run in the park and you're inspired by nature and you apply something in the world of nature to the advertising brief. But you can also make those accidents happen more consciously by sort of being deliberate about it and sort of making sure that your life is full of those diverse influences, or just sitting down and saying, right, I'm stuck on this brief. I don't know what I'm going to do next. So I'm going to apply sports to it. Or what would somebody from history do? Or what would a religious leader do about this? So, you know, you can make yourself think about it from different angles rather than just wait for one of those bits of inspiration to come your way.
That is fantastic. You know, it puts me in mind of, and I was going to come on to it anyway, but the Brian Eno, I've read an interview with him recently or heard an interview on a podcast actually, but he was talking about the methodology that he uses with oblique strategies, things that he used with, you know, people like David Bowie, who will come up later on in conversation as well. But, you know, that suddenly it's a pack of cards that he'll pull out if they've reached a kind of a stopping point, and even when they at the point where they think everything's good, then he'll pull out one of these cards, and it may say something like, you know, sort of get the bass player to play the lead guitar role or the drummer to play the bass guitar role and see what, or change the key of it. And these sorts of things can just create a whole new way of looking at things. So I think that's absolutely, you know, it's definitely a sort of a proven method.
I love all that sort of stuff. And as you say, there's loads in the world of music. One of my favorites is Tom Waits,
yes,
who listens to two radios at the same time, which I think is great. Like, so switches on two radios, different stations, and then he just watches out for unusual collisions, you know, like a lyric that doesn't go with another lyric, but that's what makes it interesting. Or like two different genres. Oh, you wouldn't expect them to go together. That's what makes it interesting. So he's looking for unexpected random connections that he can then knit together into something new, which I find fascinating.
That's very cool, because Brian Eno is doing a similar thing at the moment. He's playing with music and he's knocking out bits of musical sequences and running them simultaneously so that they're colliding at random moments, and then he's trying to find out the sort of how that the kind of effect that has. So that's fantastic, and it's a great approach. But you know, I got to say, it's great, because it's lovely to have this conversation with you, because, you know, obviously you get invited to a load of interviews and podcasts and stuff like that. But as I said a couple of weeks ago, I'm fascinated by the Lucky General story, and we can talk about this book endlessly. But I'd rather kind of want to change tack slightly, because I want to talk about the purpose behind the book, or where the book's going to benefit. In a recent study by the Social Mobility Commission, it found out that if the creative industries were as socio-economically diverse as the rest of the economy, there'd be something like 263,000 additional working class people employed in the sector, which brings me onto, obviously, who benefits from this book that you've written, and how you're using your position to kind of reach down and lift up others. And first off, just to set the scene, you started out studying law, is that right, at the University of Edinburgh?
Yeah, so, that's right, yeah.
So what pulled you into the world of advertising?
Well, I really did. This is a classic example of luck. I always sort of knew, I loved law. I really enjoyed it. It was really interesting. But I sort of knew that I didn't want to practice it, because I thought the job itself might be quite a corporate and boring and sort of suited and so on. And so I started telling my tutor at the time, and he was a lovely guy, who sort of said, well, if you like certain aspects about law, like you like assembling a story and putting someone's best case forward, but you want to do it in a more creative environment, what about advertising? And I didn't know there was a thing called advertising, but I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I didn't do anything about it immediately, but I then, when it was time to finally get my shit together, I sort of thought, right, okay, remember what he said. And what's really interesting is this guy who sort of set me on the way is a guy called Alexander McCall Smith. And I think he took his own advice. So I feel like I have helped him in his career as well as my career. But he's ended up being phenomenally much more successful than me, because he's now one of the best-selling authors in the world. So he gave up the law and started writing novels, and he sold tens of millions of novels,
right,
quite a lot more than my book, all over the world. So
far.
But that's right, so far. I think I've got a bit of catching up to do. But no, he was like, having a chance conversation, you know, to a lawyer about your career in advertising, that was a kind of an unusual sort of combination. But I think just, again, being listening and keeping your mind open to stuff that you hadn't really considered before was a good lesson there. And so I applied and I ended up at an agency called Abbott Mead Vickers, which is now one of the biggest in the country.
Not an insubstantial company, no. But do you consider yourself, I hate to sort of, it sounds such a brash question, but I mean, do you consider yourself to be a working class or coming from a working class background?
I think it's a good question. Basically, the short answer is no.
Right.
Because I think technically it depends on your what your parents were doing when they were 14. And mine was a teacher by that stage, my mum.
Right.
And my dad was a news agent. But the sort of longer, so he had a little village shop, but so we weren't like, you know, rich, but we weren't, you know, we had some money and, you know, I went to the local comprehensive, but we, you know, we weren't, we were sort of, I never had to want for anything. But I think that the sort of longer answers, both of them came from very working class backgrounds. So my mum was, before she was a teacher, the only reason really she was a teacher was that she was the youngest of 12 and her dad was a coal miner and all her brothers were coal miners and her sisters were factory workers. And because she was by far the youngest, they all sort of encouraged her to stay on at school and paid for her and supported her and said she didn't have to bring any money into the family and all that kind of, sort of stuff. So she always felt that she was incredibly lucky, to use this word again, that she had been born then. If she'd been like born a couple of positions earlier, or if she'd been a boy, she would have been down the pit like everybody else. So she inculcated this belief in me that, again, if I'd been born a generation before, I'd be down the mine as well, sort of thing.
Right.
So, and all my extended family on that side, there was tons of them. I mean, her sister had, we're a Catholic family, as you can imagine, her sister had nine kids and they all had tons of kids. So they're all like plumbers and steel yard workers and shipyard workers and stuff like that. And then on my dad's side, he was, he sort of had the opposite work. He was very working class, but he left school at 14. He was a single child, so very, very different, of a single mum. And his dad was not really involved in his upbringing and, you know, in and out of trouble with the police and all that kind of sort of stuff. And really quite a troubled sort of, his dad had quite a troubled sort of start in life and all that kind of stuff. But that made him sort of really appreciate, you know, he left school at 14, but he never begrudged any of that. And so he sort of gave me a real sort of sense that, you know, you make the best you can of stuff and you don't have to be saddled with the thing that you start off as. And both of them, like, there's nothing like working class parents to sort of give you a belief in, you know, striving and, you know, appreciating what you got and education, actually. I mean, that was the big thing that they both gave. They'd both, you know, grown up in this, you know, my mum literally had no books in the house sort of thing. And so they spent all, you know, whatever money they did have, we were surrounded by books and we're always encouraged to learn stuff. And so that's my long way of kind of saying, I don't think I can say I'm working class. And I feel like that would be, people often say that in an unhelpful way because it sort of, again, makes you underplay the luck that you've had. And I feel like I was lucky to have a more comfortable upbringing, which I'm very grateful for, and I'm grateful for their advice. But it was influenced by, you know, both my parents coming from those backgrounds.
A working class mentality, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, because we had a bit of a class debate sort of on the show for a few weeks ago with we started with Steve Harrison talking about his Can't Sell, Won't Sell book. And I mean, you know, obviously, you're familiar with it, but he claims that the advertising industry is kind of overpopulated by kind of left-wing university graduates and they're too concerned with saving the planet rather than doing what they're supposed to do, which is sell their clients' products and stuff. I mean, what's your take on that? I mean, how do you respond to that?
Ooh, it's good. I mean, Steve's obviously very smart. I don't agree with everything he says. Like, I feel like he's right that there's a certain type of person in advertising right now. It is more middle class and more sort of socially liberal and all those kind of things. I mean, I think companies these days do need to think about their place of responsibility, because perhaps in a way that what we didn't know about X number of years ago or weren't conscious of, you know, companies are potentially causing a lot of damage around the world. And, you know, diversity is an issue that they really have got to address. So all these things they must do as companies. I suppose the separate point then is, should they talk about it? Should they, you know, because one argument might say, yeah, you should just do all that good stuff, but you don't need to make that the focus of your advertising. I guess that's Steve's thesis. And I think it sort of depends, really. Like, if you've got, if that is a, for some companies, like we work with the co-op, which is, 175 years old, a cooperative business that is owned by its members, and all the money, when you buy something from it, for those who maybe are listening from elsewhere, it's like a, it, it does everything from it, like it's a supermarket, but it's also the biggest funeral provider in the UK. It's got academy schools, it's got, pharmacies and all sorts of other businesses. So it's quite an unusual thing. But the point is that the, when you buy from the co-op, the money goes back into the community. And that is an amazing selling point. And it's not like a sort of CSR thing that they are, you know, I think that's what Steve perhaps is rightly annoyed about. And we're all frustrated by is when companies are not really doing good stuff, but they sort of put this on as a sort of a bit of virtue signaling or sticking plaster that disguises what they're really doing in the community. But the co-op do that day and day. They've done it for 175 years. And that is the reason to shop there. So that is a, for me, that's a completely legitimate thing for us to talk about,
because
that
DNA.
Does persuade you. Yeah, that makes you, why would you go there rather than some big monolithic supermarket? So that is both things coming together nicely. It's ethics, but also the reason to buy my product. Where it gets harder is, as perhaps Steve has alluded, where you've got nothing really distinctive. The company's not really, doesn't really believe in any of this stuff. It's not really acting. It's just spending a lot of money on glossy advertising to make them look good. They'd be better spending it doing something rather than telling everyone how marvelous they are. So I do agree with that bit.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. And I mean, the reason that I ask you that is because, you know, that we're having this line of conversation was that, you know, I said at the top of the show, the royalties from the sale of Go Luck Yourself are donated to Commercial Break, which is a charity that's dedicated to helping redress the balance by finding employment for working class people in the creative industries. And James Hillhouse, who you very kindly put me in touch with, who runs a charity, said that, you know, a lot of agencies and networks aren't really doing enough to address this. And we're subsequently now going to have him on the show to talk about this in a bit more detail. But I learned about this a few weeks ago. I mean, Lucky Generals operates this thing called The Barracks, which is free accommodation in a purposely rented, purpose-built kind of rented flat paid for by the agency, which I think is a great thing. And, you know, but obviously not everybody can do that kind of thing. But I mean, what kind of initiatives can agencies take on, you know, to help attract and onboard more people from working class backgrounds? I mean, are there any other sorts of things that you would sort of throw out there just as sort of ideas that people could implement?
You know, actually, on that point, the first thing is, if anybody does want to do that, it's not that hard. And we don't want to hang on to that as our thing. So if anybody's interested in the logistics of how we made that work, they should just give us a shout and we'd love it if everybody did it. Because in particular in London, it's so expensive. Yeah. That's the reason that we did that, was because the housing market in London, but no doubt in lots of other big cities around the world, is so horrendous that even if you find someone great and even if you pay them properly, they still can't come down and live in your city because just the living costs are a nightmare. So I think we've got to think creatively about stuff like that, because we're a creative industry, aren't we? We should be thinking about stuff like that. I think it's about, looking for people in the right places for sure. Sort of not doing the same old university, sort of focused recruitment drives, but looking for people who haven't got degrees, or, not insisting upon that on your, when you sort of ask for CVs, and, just talking to people that have got different life experiences, and just making sure that the people who do the interviewing, so this is all the stuff that happens at the early stage, but when you interview people, just be aware of your biases. So a classic example would be, if you see someone who has worked the summer, somebody who's maybe gone around the world and done some fabulous, exciting gap year and done lots of good charity work in various countries around the world. That sounds impressive and great. Well done them. And then the next CV might be, I spent the summer working in a call center or in a shop. And you might mark them down. You might think, well, that's not very exciting or imaginative. But actually, that might be because that person couldn't afford to travel around the world and had to bring some money into the house. And actually had been really resourceful to get that job and got loads of amazing people skills. You know, we look down on some of that sort of work experience when actually that could make them a brilliant person to hire. So just a lot of it is about just making sure that we're not judging people and writing them off before they've even had a chance to prove themselves to us. And then I think the big thing, and this is one of the reasons I was so keen on giving them the royalties to James's organization, is that it's about how you make people feel like they belong. Because it's all very well getting people in the door, and then you can tick off that box and say, yeah, we've got some working class people in. But it's like, do they feel like they belong there, and do they feel comfortable? And again, just making sure that you're setting up the right environment and you're not putting people in positions that they're uncomfortable with, and or that where you're setting them up to fail. And I think that's a big part of Commercial Breaks work, which I thought was a really smart sort of distinction for them to make.
Yeah, and as I say, he's going to come on the show, and we'll do a show dedicated to the work. But I thought it was just a great initiative. And getting back to the HR thing, I mean, we were talking about HR in last week's show, but I think if we pull or draw a lesson from Brian Eno, perhaps we could get the accountants to do the next set of interviewing and see how that goes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. It's brilliant.
But anyway, so related to but not born of this topic is the matter of work ethics in the creative industry, and something that I had a conversation with Tim Lindsay about. And that's the question of burnout, which Tim attributes to the sort of demands of clients on agencies and that incredibly bad habit that some clients are accused of having, you know, where they need three or four ideas in a week instead of one really excellent idea. And I mean, I've got to ask you this question. I mean, have you ever had clients that do that sort of thing, that put excessive demands on Danny's department or his team skills or whatever? And what is a great way to, you know, how do you temper that? Because obviously you don't want to turn around and say, look, you're only getting one idea and it's going to be the best one. I mean, is there a handy way to respond to that kind of thing? And you can swear if you need to.
Do you know what? I can honestly say that the best, how we've handled it, is by not making it happen in the first place. Well, because we're like a founder-led company, we have been very picky about who we work with in the first place. We've never wanted to be the biggest company. We've never wanted a huge client list. I mean, we've really got, I don't want to say a number now because I'm going to offend someone by forgetting now, but it's like, you know, we don't have that many more. We've got, I don't know, like 10 clients, if that. And probably a bit less really sort of really core clients. And so we've been very careful to choose people that we like, who we feel have got the same sort of values as us, who wouldn't put us in that position.
Right.
Now, what happens then, I suppose, is sometimes, like classic example of the last 2 years, where for all the reasons we know, people are under stress and everything's up in the air. And you got to, you know, sometimes that has put pressures on everybody, because it's like the pressures are on our clients, and that then spills over into pressure on us. And then you've got to feel your way through it. You've got to, you know, in some cases you might have to sort of muck in and get your sleeves rolled up because they're in the shit and you've got to be in the trenches with them and all the rest of it for a little while. But you've got to recognize that is an unusual state of affairs and can't go on forever. So like, for what, one of the things we always do is we if people have to sort of work weekends, for instance, they get that time back. It's not like just assume that is what, you know, you just have to do that for free sort of thing. If people have to go beyond the call of duty, you know, we make sure that they take time off afterwards. And actually, you know, we get their partners also to take time off, because that causes, you know, sort of impacts on partners as well, sort of thing. So we pay for them to do stuff. We rotate people through, you know, if clients are particularly busy, like retail clients are sometimes quite tough. And so you can only spend so long on them. And then you sort of rotate, you know, so that you get a chance to do something else. As a rule, we never ever have someone only working 100% on an account as well, because that means that your whole life is dominated by this thing, and everyone needs an outlet, you know, 10% or 20% client that's a completely different thing, a charity or something like that, so that you have you know, some variety in your life. And, you know, then it's a case of just saying to our clients, no. And having the, we've never had a client that we'd be scared to leave. You know, don't listen to this, any of my lovely clients, and think, right, we're off ski. But you need to have that fearlessness. You need to have a sort of sense that.
Confidence.
Confidence. And they know that. Everybody knows that, that we're not desperate. And you'd never be desperate. That's a big part of this, which is why be careful who you work with. And then just have very honest conversations and play it by ear, so that you're sort of either saying, you know what, you are asking for a hell of a lot right now, but we understand why, because you're under the cost yourself. So we're going to, just this once, we're going to make a difference. But don't think this is the way that we're always going to do it. So that can sometimes be a sensible thing to do, and it shows that you're partners. But other times also to be able to say, yeah, this is, we're calling the quits now. We're not going to work like this any longer. You know, we have to part company nicely, and we're not going to put our people through this.
Well, I mean, that brings me on to the question for all the CMOs that are out there. I mean, what in your mind, what makes a great client? What core skills do they need to develop? Because, I mean, not everyone's worked with, this is the thing about it, not everyone has worked with creative people before. And so they don't spot the signs. They expect them to work like, you know, producing a spreadsheet or something and ever. So, I mean, what core skills does a client need? And what are the kind of warning signs of one of those bad relationships?
I suppose what makes good people, good relationships generally, I mean, it's kind of, honesty is like the bedrock of it. I think you've got to be able to have honest conversations, including when something's going wrong, you know, so that on either side, so that we can say, you know, based on that last conversation we're having, you know, this is, you're driving us crazy now, or this is our team are falling to bits. You know, you're working us too hard. You're not paying us enough. We need to get reinforcements or whatever. You know, you've got to be able to put up a white flag and say, right, enough, this can't happen. They equally have to kind of be able to say, we're not happy with X, Y, Z, and not feel that we're going to be offended and throw our toys out the pram. Because most problems are better dealt with if you're just honest about it. Where a lot of problems between agencies and clients go wrong is when you try to sort of brush it under the carpet and pretend it's not happening and hope that it'll go away. And then the problem gets bigger, because that person that you don't like and you don't want on your team and is a nightmare just pisses more and more people off. Or that thing that was a little niggle when you started now just becomes a really, you know, aggravating factor. It's the toothpaste thing, isn't it, that people always talk about in couples, like it's the fact that you're sort of, you know, squeezing the toothpaste at the wrong end of the tube sort of thing, and which starts off as a small thing, and then you want to kill each other sort of thing. So, honesty, I think, is the main thing. And then above that is ambition. You know, do your best work for the people who want you to do your best work. That's a truism, isn't it? And in our case, it's fun as well. You know, we like to work with people who've got a sense of humor and fun. All we're doing is, you know, advertising our, you know, brand stuff and business. We're not usually, I mean, sometimes we are saving lives for health campaigns and stuff like that. But usually what we are doing is not so hugely important in the grand scheme of things. And just a bit of levity goes a long way.
Oh, that's fantastic! That's fantastic. And talking of saving lives and great campaigns and stuff, I mean, I did ask you to just sort of put together a list of your sort of top three all time favorite campaigns. I mean, I don't know if you're able to, but I'd love to hear what you judge to be sort of great campaigns. They can be yours, or they can be anybody's. So it doesn't matter.
No, I thought I wouldn't choose mine. I feel like that would be, they'd make everyone hate me even more. I thought Guinness Good Things Come to Those Who Wait is like a brilliant idea. It's a brilliant strategy and a brilliant insight. And it's a great example of taking something that looks like a bad thing, the fact you've got to wait for your pint to get served, and turning that into a great thing. You know, because good things happen to those who wait. It's such a great thought, great line. And then the execution, though, is, you know, for all those ads, was mind-blowingly brilliant. I mean, the Surfers ad in particular.
Tell you what, take follow the top.
We can probably all remember. I remember being in a pub when that came on, watching football, and people were just awestruck by it. And, you know, that's an amazing sort of benchmark to think, God, at our very best, that's what we can do. We can make people properly awestruck. So I loved that, and it was long running, and it could only be from Guinness. And then I thought, bit different. There's the Got Milk campaign in the States.
Oh, yes.
By Goodby Silverstein, which again has been running for decades now. But it's based on such a simple insight, this idea that we don't really think about milk until we run out.
Got milk.
And I just feel like that's such a brilliant, you know, we use this word insight an awful lot, and sometimes we expect it to be, you know, unbelievably profound and, you know, ridiculously overblown. But that's quite a simple insight that turned into the most amazing campaign for 20 or 30 years. You kept on thinking they're never going to be able to think of a different way to do that insight, but they keep on coming up with more and more great executions. So I love that too. And again, I suppose, you know, being a strategist, I like campaigns that got a really strong strategy and then a brilliant creative, you know, execution, and together those things are, you know, just dynamite. And then the third
running
one
as well, doesn't it? That one, I mean, the Got Milk has become part of the vocabulary.
Of course,
now, you know.
Yeah, and it's famous to people who are, you know, I don't know if that's ever run in the UK, but people, I don't mean just in advertising, but I think people generally in our culture have kind of heard of that because we've watched movies where it's cropped up. It's a cultural reference point. It's like, what's up? That was the other one I was going to put in, you know. But, you know, that such an amazing, simple observation of culture that you would think might only last for one ad, but, you know, it was obviously an ongoing phenomenon. So there, I've sneaked that in by...
That's okay. You're allowed.
That's my other one. But the final one I was going to talk about was Skittles, because... And the idea of, you know, taste the rainbow, just because it's funny.
Touch the rainbow, taste the rainbow.
And there's a lot of research now, isn't there, like that funny advertising is on a massive decline. I mean, if you look at the Cannes winners this year, there was virtually nothing. I know it's been a somber year and all the rest of it, but you could argue that makes humour even more important. Some of our best work in the last couple of years has been funny stuff that puts a smile on your face in these very difficult times. And I think we're all becoming very poor-faced and serious, and we forget how powerful funny can be. And it's proven that funny advertising can be some of the most effective advertising too, because it disarms you. It's like a good salesman, isn't it? If they can make you laugh, then they can also sell you something at the same time. So I think that Skittles campaign is just so gloriously stupid and bonkers and idiotic half the time that it's just really funny, and we should celebrate that.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I will put all the links to all those adverts in the show notes, and we'll let everybody else celebrate them. And I think that's just a fantastic top three or four now, actually. So thank you very much for that. Okay, and right, well, I mean, we are rocking along here as well, Andy, so thank you very much indeed. But now, a bit more homework that you did for me, and I've been dying for this one. The first one up the first time this the artist has been mentioned, but Desert Island Disc, your tune for our Spotify playlist. Go right ahead.
It's Changes by David Bowie. Just an amazing song.
Fantastic.
But with a plop, you know, it was an absolute failure at first. I think when he first released it, it bombed. And then I think it only became a success as a B-side of something else. And it's really only in retrospect now, when we look back at his life and we see how he went through all these changes himself, and it's become a sort of a motif for this amazing restless creative spirit and embracing change. We sort of look back on it now as this masterpiece because of all those things. So I like it. I like it because it's a great song.
Sure.
But also, I guess it does sort of encourage us all to change and move with the times, which he was obviously the master of. So I think I'd choose that one.
And I think I did mention it to you as well. But one of his mottos, which I absolutely live by, and I'm sure you guys do as well at Lucky Generals as well, is that, you know, you only really become seriously creative when you get yourself out there in kind of the uncomfortable zone when you're never quite sure this is going to pay off, and that's when the real magic starts to happen. So you know, I think you know that in the world of advertising, that has got to be, you know, sort of one of the things that we need to try and introduce more.
Danny always says that, is it when if you were asking him what's a good client, he'd say someone you can feel uncomfortable outside of, you know, when you're going in to meet a client with some new work, you're either feeling uncomfortable because you're thinking, oh, this is, you know, what are they going to say? Is this too crazy for them? They probably won't buy it. You know, they're conservative. You know, that's bad feeling of uncomfortable where you think they're just going to blow everything out. Or is it, oh my God, this is so great and crazy that, you know, is it good enough for them? And are they going to, you know, is it going to be uncomfortable in a good way? And the best word does make you feel uncomfortable. Because it's not been done before, and having that, and having a client that can live with that lack of comfort and not just blow it out because of that is a good thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I mean, you can see where it comes through in the sort of the execution of a lot of the work that you do. But okay, so have you got a book for our Zoom bookshelf that everybody needs to have behind them now?
Yeah, it's something I've just listened to an audio book, which is called The Young Team by Graham Alexander.
Ooh, okay.
Which is about a Scottish working class kid's experience growing up in gang culture. So it touches on some of the other things you've talked about. It's just absolutely brilliant read. And it's part of this new school, I suppose, of work, you know, like the Booker Prize winner was Shuggy Bain. And I suppose they follow on from Irvine Welsh, but people writing about their own experiences in their own language. It might be quite tough for those of you who don't
speak the Scottish.
You might have to swat up on your vocabulary beforehand or find yourself a Glaswegian friend or something like that. But it's just really, I mean, it's funny, it's gritty, it's tough, but very generous spirited as well. And I absolutely adored it. And the audiobook is read by the author.
Oh, wow.
So the intonation is just absolutely brilliant. So,
oh, good. Any thoughts on doing an audio version of Go Like?
No, I did that, but I thought nobody wants to listen to my nasally tones. So one of the weirdest things about this whole enterprise was getting and choosing someone to do the audiobook. And so I did get someone Scottish,
right?
But with a much better voice than me. You know, I've gone for the, you know, it's not quite Ewan McGregor because I couldn't quite afford him, but someone with an equally amazing Scottish voice rather than my sort of nasal sort of twang. But it's quite a sort of strange thing because you're sort of, it's a bit like finding yourself a body double.
Yes.
But a better looking body double. So it's, the brief was find someone who sounds a little bit like me, but considerably better. And there's a guy called Neil Glasgow who I found who was really good.
Great name. Fantastic. It's almost like the voice that you think you should have.
Yeah, that's it. I'd love it if people listened to it and thought it was actually me. That's maybe what some people will do.
By the way, I love the adverts you're putting out at the moment for those, for the book as well. They are hilarious. Absolutely brilliant.
Cheers, yeah.
Always made me smile.
Yeah, we're trying to promote the book in a way that is true to the book. So if the book is about luck and about having fun and your creativity in your working life, then the way you promote it should be fun and creative and, you know, lucky. And so, yeah, we've done lots of silly things to promote it along those lines.
That's fantastic. Excellent. Okay, now this one is going to be spectacular, and I will reveal why. Okay, we introduced this game a while back. It's called What Three Words. We use the What Three Words search engine, and I asked you for three words, and what did you come back with?
Well, I thought I'd do one word, which is you know, typical planner, change the brief. Because I think good planners should be able to say things in one word, not three. So I've chosen distilled, which also works because I'm Scottish and I like a drink, I suppose.
Right. I didn't even think about that. I thought of distilling the thoughts and stuff like that.
So. Yes, that's mostly what it was.
Right.
I thought I'd just get that insult in first in case you said it. But no, it's sort of, I think good strategy is about taking three words and making them into one, or taking big complicated ideas or complicated issues in society and making them simple. And I hate the school of planning that is about intellectual, you know, sort of pomposity or over intellectualizing stuff. I really, really strongly believe that. That's why I think, you know, my upbringing in a very ordinary, you know, neither very rich nor very poor, just like being somewhere in the middle, like ordinary, using ordinary language is a really good thing for a strategist to be able to use, I think.
Oh, that's fantastic. And well, I tell you why. Now, I actually put that into the What Three Words search engine. And of course, it kicked me straight out because obviously, you know, you have to have three words. And so I added two more to it, which was, so we now have distilled and lucky generals. Okay. Which I put together, and you aren't going to believe what this. This actually puts you in Bethel, in Alaska. Okay, and what I normally like to try and do is try and find a sort of an interesting factoid about Bethel or about the destination. And of course, you're in the middle of nowhere in Alaska, and you're not going to believe what happened here. All right. And it feeds right into your book. I thought it was so extraordinary. In 2012, okay, there was a prank. The people of Bethel were pranked because somebody told them that Taco Bell were going to open up a restaurant there.
Amazing.
Okay. And the whole place started going nuts, all right? But it wasn't going to happen, all right? And the people of Taco Bell heard about this, and they flew in a truck with all the ingredients, with 10,000 pounds worth, all right, in weight of taco ingredients, all right, and set up a small shop for them so that they could have Taco Bell. And this feeds right into one of your stories in your book about, you know, taking advantage of luck when it actually sort of, you know, comes in weird shapes and forms and running with it, because it turned out to be a fantastic marketing sort of push for Taco Bell. So I just had to get that in there because it's just so, it just encapsulates everything about the book as well. So thank you very much.
That's fantastic. No, thank you. That's great. I love the sound of that. I want to go to Alaska, so I'll have to make sure I go there.
Well, I will. I'll put the link to the story in the show notes on sort of on the website as well, so that everybody else can read it, because it's just a fabulous story, and it's just a sort of a great end to it. And I thought, so we've got Distilled, Lucky, and Generals, and you're in Bethel, Alaska. So well done, Andy. Excellent stuff.
Good.
And so. Right. So what's coming up in the not too distant future when you're back in action again?
Well, it's that time of year when we're all, you know, we're just about to launch loads of holiday stuff and Christmas stuff. We've got Amazon.
I was going to say, you've got stuff. Rather a large retailer to look after.
That's right. A sort of a little retailer from Seattle. So we're doing lots of work with them right now, doing lots of work with the co-op. We just won Virgin Atlantic in the summer. So, and of course, they're cheering because the skies have just been opened up, transatlantically. So we'll be doing lots of exciting things for them. They're just like a fantastic mission-driven company. We just won OVO. We won that on the same day as Virgin Atlantic. So that was a very lucky day.
Okay.
Which is one of the top, I think it's the number three energy company in the UK. It's all about green energy, so it's very much, you know, of the moment, sort of the carbon zero future and all the rest of it. And yeah, lots of, you know, our old favourites like Yorkshire Tea, you know, just an absolute delight to work with, the nicest people in the world, and always do great work with us. So we're so happy. You know, we, as I say, we've only got, you know, between half a dozen and sort of 10 or so sort of clients, and we know them all very well. It's the long partnerships in most cases, and yeah, we're very happy with our lot in life.
Oh, that is fantastic. Well, Andy, this has been an honour, and I genuinely mean it, and a privilege to talk to you. So thank you very much. And if any listeners are interested in finding out more about the good work of Commercial Break or the Alliance, which is Brixton Finishing School, Create Not Hate, Liberty, WYK, I've got to remember to get everybody in, Agent Academy, etc., etc. Or indeed, if you want to talk to Andy and his team, we'll put all the details to the show in the show notes at at thefuelpodcast.com. In the meantime, Andy, I'd like to wish you the very best of luck, but obviously somebody else has beaten me to it. So instead, I'll live long and prosper and say hi and thank you to all the team at Lucky Generals. And I sincerely hope that our paths cross again soon. All the best.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it. And I should tell you to go luck yourself.
Go luck yourself too. And there goes Andy. I had hundreds more questions to ask him because getting him on the show is like being able to do what Benjamin Franklin failed to do, which is capture lightning in a bottle. I don't need to sell Go Luck Yourself any more strongly. It's a fantastic read and is packed full of great ways that you can make luck look your way and come over and buy you a drink. We'll put a link to the book in the show notes on the website. We'll also put a link to the Commercial Break Organisation where you can find out more about the great work that it does in helping working class talent break into the creative business. And if you want to work with Lucky Generals, you'll need to get in line, but the wait will be worth it. Good luck, Andy, and the Lucky Generals team. It's going to be a busy next few months for you all, but I'm sure you'll meet the challenge with yet more award-winning creative campaigns. All the show stuff can be found at www.thefuelpodcast.com. Please like, subscribe, and tell your friends and colleagues about us. And also, think about subscribing to The Advertist if you want to drive your new business campaigns. Thank you for listening and helping us go further than both Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos in the podcasting space. We now have more listeners than Disney World had visitors in 2 hours. That's amusing. Also, my thanks go to co-producer Donna, to the band The Prospectors, and finally to Matt Smith at Queegee Bow Design in downtown Indianapolis for providing all the IT support. Thanks for listening to this hour of a show, and we hope you enjoyed it. Until next time, my friends, I look forward to bringing you the very best in new business tips, tricks, and techniques. Stay safe, stay alert, and be prepared, because you never know when luck's going to look your way. For now, this is me, your host, a Smith called Keith, signing off from Fuel, the podcast for the new business curious. And really, shouldn't that include you?